Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Millions of ordinary people witnessed the crimes of the Holocaust and did nothing. Today, we talk about the bystanders. Our guest for this conversation is Haley Brooks. She presents the talk Holocaust Choices as part of the Rapid City Speaker Series at Black Hill State University in Spearfish. That's tonight at 6:30 p.m. Mountain Time. Haley Brooks, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with your interest in this topic. You've spent some time at the National Holocaust Museum, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. I actually have always been interested in World War II history. I'm a huge history buff, but especially World War II and the Holocaust and how such a huge atrocity could happen. And, you know, genocide is still happening in today's world. So I've always been interested in that. And it was actually Black Hill State University, a course called Politics of the Holocaust with Dr. Havila, when I attended the university, that I guess kind of further launched my interest in the topic, and led me to become involved in following institutions on social media, which is how I learned about the internship at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C.
That must be emotional work to do on a daily basis. Tell me about that.
Well, you know, it is really emotional, and I don't want to say that you become desensitized to it. I think the more information that I learn about the Holocaust, and especially very specific stories, such as Irene Gut Updike's, who I'll be speaking about this evening, it actually fires my passion even more and makes me determined to try and do what I can to spread education and be an advocate for awareness of not only the choices that we make on a daily basis, but just Holocaust and genocide studies in general.
So what do we know about bystanders and those who were not members of the Nazi Party but witnessed things? What do we exactly know about their contribution and complicit actions to during this time?
One thing in my research and my studies that I've found out is these choices that people have or faced and made is very complex and certainly has a lot of layers to them. And every situation has different elements that affect people's decision making. And so I'm going to be highlighting some of that information in my speech this evening that Some Were Neighbors exhibit hosted by the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in D.C. has that looks about the different motives and pressures that people faced on a regular basis. One specific example that I really is powerful to me is the exhibit juxtaposes decisions made by people who are in the same situation. So, for example, there were two different police officers, and one chose to turn a Jewish teacher over to the SS during Kristallnacht, while the other one chose to actually protect a family from an angry mob during Kristallnacht. So, you know, it makes you wonder, if you're in the same position of authority, you have the same orders of German decree, but you made the decision to help versus, you know, turn somebody in. So I think analyzing those factors and just trying to make decisions or at least be aware that every individual has a decision to make is extremely important. And I think education is the key to all of that.
What do we know about what happens to some of those individuals after their decisions are made?
And that's really interesting. You know, everyone, some of the decisions that people made are affected on how, you know, are they going to be punished? Are they going to be looked at differently? You know, in some situations, they were either arrested or sent to labor camps, while other situations, they got by miraculously and helped in their helped by making that decision.
Sure. So, do we hear from them? I want to talk about the survivors of the Holocaust and their thoughts afterwards about their neighbors. But first, I want to know, do we have any oral history from people who made one decision or another, and have they come forward and say, this is how it impacted the rest of my life, even today?
Yes, and there's actually a lot. And again, I've just recently been trying to find more and more research, as it's not exactly a huge, you know, everyone talks about the Nazis and the atrocities, but these little gems of stories where people did, you know, speak out and make these decisions. And one of those people is Irene Gut-Updike, who was a Polish girl in 1939, was 17 years old, just out of high school, who made the decision to help. And she is one of the many oral histories that survive. Her daughter, Jeannie Smith, actually speaks about her mother's experience during the war, as well as after the war. And so that's a really powerful lesson that we can learn, because somebody who made the decision to help did so, and is, you know, sharing her experience and sharing the message and importance of loving everyone as a human being. I mean, we're all humans in the end, and that's super powerful.
She has to have complicated feelings about what she did, though. Because I'm sure, how does she feel? Does she feel like she did enough? You could never do enough?
I think given the circumstances, you know, and it's hard to, I don't want to, you know, speak for her by any means, but just from my research, I feel like it is difficult. And I think in the end, especially somebody who has the moral conviction to do what is right, always wonders if they did enough. But I definitely think, especially Irene's story, is admirable, because she did what she could within the context of her surroundings and environment to help. And I think when it comes down to that.
What do some of the survivors say about the role of their neighbors?
Some were neighbors exhibit at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum has a lot of testimony, and you can actually find videos of testimony of Holocaust survivors on the USHM's website at www.ushmm.org. And their testimony is very powerful. And one of the things that I remember specifically about my internship at the museum is they have a voiceover recording of testimony and oral stories. And one of the things was a woman who said, "She was my friend, I thought. We were friends. We grew up together. We went to school together. We had fun together." And so I think there's definitely a lot of hurt and pain and bewilderment as to why somebody who grew up with them, why somebody who were neighbors to them and, you know, all of a sudden changed the way they were treated, changed their relationship, you know. And again, there's a lot of factors that come into play with that, especially in the situation of the Holocaust and, you know, the rise of Nazi Germany. And there's a long history of anti-Semitism built within that as well. But again, I think it's very important that we educate and learn from these histories and these lessons from the Holocaust specifically, as well as other genocide situations, that we can apply even to today's world, you know.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to In the Moment. Our guest is Haley Brooks, and she's presenting the talk Holocaust Choices. It's part of the Rapid City Speaker Series at Black Hills State University. That's tonight at 6:30 Mountain. Haley, what are some of those pressures that bystanders felt and responded to? Fear seems to be a good place to start.
Yes, definitely. Fear of persecution, definitely. In the environment during World War II and the rise of the Nazi regime, there was pressures from the German government and the Nazi regime, German decrees against Jews and those who would help Jews. So you always had the fear of being punished, being sent to labor camps, the fear of your decision affecting, like, your family members and other loved ones. As some other factors and pressures would probably be just social pressures, like, what would other people think of me? Will people judge me? Will family members judge me, or, you know, have an issue with me standing up? Other factors can be advancement. So definitely economic hardships was a huge factor also that helped lead to the rise of Nazi Socialist Party and career advancement, looking to help yourself. So that's greed, those kinds of things. So, you know, again, it's a very complex layer.
So some people are actually getting ahead. They're not just turning a blind eye. They're capitalizing on it economically and professionally.
Yes, exactly. So one example of that could be looters. So after Jewish persons were deported, there would be neighbors and other people in the town that would go into their house, take their belongings, take valuables, things like that, or even in their shops. So that's definitely a factor where, okay, they don't have it anymore, so it's mine. But when it comes down to it, no, that should still be theirs, and we should have made other choices.
Do they know what's happening? How aware are they? Are the bystanders really, what's their awareness level of what's really happening to these folks? To their Jewish neighbors who are, you know, all of a sudden wearing a star and then the next day they're gone. Do they know what's happening in their country?
Again, that's a very complex question. And I think, you know, hindsight is 2020, so retrospectively speaking, they had to know something was happening. Mm-hmm. I do feel that, especially in the beginning, they probably had less of an inclination to say something or to stand up. But definitely when it gets into the war years, and certainly towards the end of the war years, there had to have been an understanding of things that were happening, or the fact that they were going places. And the interesting thing that the Summer Neighbors exhibit at the museum shows are photographs taken. Mm-hmm. So one of the most powerful ones that I saw was, you have a ghetto, which was where Jewish persons were sent to and basically secluded in one specific area, and there was a bridge over one side of the ghetto to the other where you had to cross. And so you had people who were living their regular lives who knew that the conditions inside the ghetto were terrible and saw these people on a regular basis. So I think there had to have been some knowledge, especially later and during the later war years, for sure.
What kind of resistance worked? Resistance from non-Jews trying to help the people who were being rounded up. What sort of things were effective?
You know, it's interesting because, again, different situations and environmental factors play a big role in those decision-making choices. But some of the things, you know, were maybe small acts of defiance, such as sneaking food to people like Jewish people or others that were persecuted that didn't have food. Or, you know, something as big as hiding people or protecting them. One of the stories I'll be telling this evening is about a man who worked at a paper mill factory, and he was Jewish, and his foreman told him not to wear the Star of David, which was a German decree, so that Jews could be identified. And he said, don't wear your star because they'll be able to tell that you're Jewish. And so for a long time, he hid within this paper mill and worked for this gentleman because that gentleman chose not to follow the decree to have him wear his star.
What are the lessons for today, Haley, from these people that that survived this time and have told their story, and from the millions who did not? What are the lessons for us?
I think one of the most important lessons, you know, something like the Holocaust is such a large event that happened, and you see things that exist today in society. You still have prejudice. You still have racism. You still have, you know, I guess on a smaller scale, the same kind of elements that led up to something as atrocious as the Holocaust. And mm-hmm. I think that by educating ourselves about, A, not only what caused the Holocaust to happen, but looking at different factors, and just remembering that every single person has an individual choice that they can make when they're confronted on a daily basis with something even as small as, you know, maybe an off-color joke or racial comments, things like that. And I think, again, another very important factor is educating, especially younger generations and future generations of society, that you can make a difference. One person can make a difference. So for school-age children, elementary school-age children, you know, it could be as simple as seeing someone being bullied on a school in the playground.
Sure.
Is this something that they're going to stand up for? Are they going to stand up for that person? Are they just going to let it happen? And I think by explaining and teaching and nurturing them to understand that they can have the courage and conviction to do what is morally right is very important.
Haley Brooks speaks tonight at Black Hills State University in Spearfish as part of their speaker series. You can see her at 6:30 p.m. Mountain Time. Haley, thank you so much for your time today.
Yes, thank you so much, Lori.
When we come back, art at any age. You're in the moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Art is a lifelong pursuit. Pablo Picasso painted well into his later years, famously believing that art kept him alive, and his is not the only story. Next up, we talk about a South Dakota art exhibition that honors work by the oldest among us. Luann Severson is Director of Public Affairs and Professional Development with the South Dakota Healthcare Association. She joins us to talk about the Dakota Masterworks Art Show. Luann, welcome to Dakota. Welcome
that
to In the Moment.
I know, we are in the moment.
You're in the moment. That's the first time I've done that after 3 weeks of changing.
That's all right. Well, thank you so much, Lori. I really appreciate you reaching out to us about this positive aging venture we're on.
So talk to me about the South Dakota Healthcare Association. What's the mission there?
Sure. South Dakota Healthcare Association is a trade association in South Dakota that works with long-term care providers. And we are the leading long-term care association in South Dakota with our members consisting of nursing homes, assisted living, and senior living centers.
So why art and why an art exhibition?
I know. You would wonder, what does art have to do with South Dakota Healthcare Association? Well, back in 1997, so 20 years ago, we kind of reached out with this thought of a positive aging campaign and kind of thought, well, let's take the venture on as art. And none of us here in the office were artists, but we're hoping that kind of rubs off on us. And we kind of reached out to South Dakotans to see if anybody over the age of 60 would be interested in pursuing artwork or if they would like to enter the show. And before long, we were getting entries in. In our first year, we got 50 entries in, ranging, you know, mostly of people in their 60s and 70s. And then word started getting out, and of course we couldn't do this without sponsorship, and we have a number of sponsors that are so wonderful to, you know, be part of this and help us in this. And I just do want to take a moment here to quickly, you know, give a thank you to Keloland TV, Great Western Bank, Skyline Healthcare, Wellcove Healthcare, Tealwood Senior Living, Clarkson Healthcare, West Hills Village, Teason Memorial Home, Dalrymple Village, Jenkins Living Center, Good Samaritan Society, Fisher Rounds and Associates, Sitson Printing, Mollanders Lighting and Appliance, and Imagery Photography. And now, 20 years later, we have won some national awards through the National Mature Media and just for the community awareness that we have brought of positive aging, and the second half of life can be full of creative ventures. And so now, 20 years later, we hold our annual show generally in October or November, and we have a large exhibit that has grown now to about 200 entries.
Are you finding that many of the people who participate are new artists? Or are you finding these people who have had experience in the arts all along?
You know, I would say it was a combination of both. We have our veteran artists that come back every year and just enjoy meeting people, meeting other artists. And then we have new ones come in, and they just really enjoy the competitive side of it because we do have an award show for it. And then the winning pieces, we take about 42 of them that travel around the state just to various nursing centers. And now we're so excited that this week, tomorrow, we're going to be in Pierre and set up a reception, a legislative reception, where we're going to highlight and showcase the winning entries.
How do you encourage somebody who might not have a lot of experience with a particular medium or showcasing their art in any way? How are folks in long-term care facilities, nursing homes, assisted living, encouraging people to explore the arts at an older age?
Sure, and that's what's so neat about this particular show is that it isn't just people that are in nursing centers that are entering the show. We have so many people that tell us that they didn't find that they had an art talent until the second half of life, after the grandchildren came to their house and they got out the paint by numbers. And we don't accept paint by numbers in our show, but that's how they got the start. And before long, they had this hidden talent that they didn't know. It can be in oil, acrylics, watercolor, drawing, painting, photography, sculpture, and wood carving. And you'd be so amazed of people that have illnesses that we see come, and you turn on some music or you put a paintbrush in their hand and just this calmness comes over them. And, you know, cancer patients, people with Parkinson's can paint beautiful, beautiful works of art.
I'm curious about the subject matter, and I know you're not an art historian by any stretch, but I'm curious about the subject matter that that shows up in the entries and how that sort of reflects on the age and geography, really, of the artists.
Sure. You know, we do get a lot of, South Dakota being a rural state, we see a lot of, a lot of country scenes, barns, farms. We see a lot of Native American heritage coming through in the pictures. We have sculptors that just are amazing, and you can be very creative in what they submit. So we just have such a wide range, and that's what I always tell people is I can guarantee if you walk through the show, I can guarantee that it will spark a memory from the past for you, or there will always be something that will just intrigue you of that it's amazing that someone could carve such a unique piece out of a piece of wood or just paint something that just looks so real, like it's jumping out at you.
Any interaction between the artists and exhibit goers?
Always, always. That is the fun part about it, is seeing them interact with each other, and young and old. This year, of course, we have grandchildren that come through to view their grandparents' artwork, and you have to be at least 60 to enter. And this year, our oldest entrant this year was 98 years old. And we do have a piece that is traveling in the art show from a 95-year-old woman, and we're just so excited to share all of this talent that actually comes from all over South Dakota.
I'm thinking about legacy. Then when you talk about people who have illnesses, I used to do residency in the hospitals, and I know those artists and residents are working with people who might be on the final months of their life, and some of that art was really considered legacy art. Do you think there's an opportunity here for capturing some of that self-expression and saving it when these artists are gone?
Yes. Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. That is a very unique piece of this that we have seen. We have had artists that have begun their artwork, and it was the last piece of kind of their hobby that they were completing, and they wanted to finish it. More than once we've seen this, and they submit it in the show. And it's an emotional thing to see family members. It's emotional for me. I get so wrapped up in the stories that are behind each piece, because we have an artist statement that comes in that you're able to view with each entry. And I can see where that legacy then is carried on. And I'm so glad that we can be part of that and bring family members to see their loved ones' talents.
South Dakota Healthcare Association Masterworks Art Show can be viewed at the Ramcota Hotel and Pier tomorrow evening from 6 to 8 p.m. That's in Gallery D. Public is invited, and it's free. Luann Severson, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Lori.
Neil Tapio is a South Dakota senator from Watertown. He was alongside many from South Dakota who witnessed the inauguration of President Donald Trump in Washington, D.C. Senator Tapio joins us now from Pierre. Welcome to In the Moment. Neil Tapio, do we have you here?
Oh, hello.
Hi. Welcome to In the Moment.
How can you hear me?
I can hear you now. How are you, sir?
Oh, excellent. It's good to be with you and your listeners.
All right. So you made it back from Washington, D.C. To Pierre to do the state business. But tell us about why you wanted to go and see the inauguration of the 45th president.
Well, that's a very good question. So I guess I was the state director for Donald Trump for his campaign in South Dakota. And so in the last couple months, I was actually went to work in northern Colorado and was one of the state directors there for the campaign. So I've been a long time supporter of Mr. Trump as well as an employee. So in that, and then I'm also a state legislator, and I just kind of care about the direction of the country, and it was an enjoyable to be a part of a winning team from my perspective, and then also to be a part of a transition, a peaceful transition of power.
Mm. Tell me about the event. Where were you at?
Well, the most exciting part, you know, it started the day before. They had a nice concert and a kind of a patriotic tribute. So I was on the memorial or the wall or the Washington Monument, and then there's a reflecting pool to the Jefferson Memorial. So they had a concert and a day before event there where it was probably 100,000 people that were in attendance. And so that was very nice. They had a Toby Keith concert as well as Lee Greenwood and several folks. And then President Trump and Vice President Pence were there. Mm-hmm. And then for the inauguration itself, unfortunately, I wasn't in the good seats. you didn't get the dignitaries and the people that actually have power were sitting there, but I was somewhere behind that mass of humanity. So,
tell me what you thought of his speech.
Well, I thought it was good. You know, just as your listeners, you know, I think it's important to know that the country is in a, you start with this perspective that people are scared for their children and their grandchildren's future. I think that's what we all share in common. And I think there's very big problems. And from my perspective, the government is broke. We're $20 trillion in debt. We're spending $600 billion more than we take in every year as a government on a $4 trillion budget. And if interest rates went up just 2%, which is historical average, we'd have a $1.2 trillion debt. And so the political system, in my perspective, is broken and isn't capable of handling problems of that nature. And so what I appreciated is Trump's bluntness. And his speech was a very blunt, direct speech saying that we're going to get things done. And so I looked at it as a speech, as a problem solver would look at a problem. And it was interesting to see how, you know, he's going to hit the ground running. He's not going to be politically correct. He looks at the system as Republicans and Democrats are kind of in this together. The system is on trial. Not any individual, but the system is on trial, and the system has failed us. And he, in my perspective, brought out that we need to change the system.
I'm really curious to know what you like about and what you think other voters who voted for President Trump, what do you like about his lack of political correctness? Because he's certainly been criticized for some of those words as well. And people don't call them politically incorrect. They call them racist or misogynistic or threatening. So what is it about the way he speaks that is so appealing to you?
So, and that's a good question. I sat on the plane ride home with two women that went to the Women's March, the Million Women's March. And it was a very fascinating question because they asked me the exact same thing.
Yeah.
How can the bluntness, the directness, the harsh remarks, I wouldn't teach my kids. One of them was a school teacher. I wouldn't teach my kids to act like that. The other one was a very high level fundraiser at a college in Colorado. And her mindset was, it's just not the way we get along. And I guess my response to that was, we have such big problems. Trump is only a result of the political system up to this time. And so because we just had a growing and growing and growing and growing size of the budget, and we haven't been able to say no, it's really easy for the political system, the way it's designed, is to go 535 individual members from around the country to go to Washington with your palm up and your hand out. And it's what you can bring back to South Dakota or Minnesota or any state, and that's how you get reelected. I saved Ellsworth. I fought for the farm bill. I was able to do this. I was able to bring a health committee or a health clinic to this small town. If everybody goes to Washington with that mentality, and you're going to have an ever-increasing size of government. The hardest thing, the biggest lesson I've learned in the first 3 weeks of my service to the state of South Dakota is it's incredibly difficult to say no. It's much easier to say yes because you don't offend anybody, at least the people that are in front of you. Mm. Well, that's the system that has gotten us into problems, and that's why we are broke as a country. And we have to just bring some sort of a control into the government system. That's why every time you deal with a government, people have story after story of why it's so frustrating, why it doesn't work. Bureaucracy, by the very nature, tries to create plausibilities and ways to justify a larger and larger and larger operation, mm-hmm. but there's no way to get it smaller and smaller and smaller. The key for everything is to try to give the power as close to the people providing the service as possible. And any layers above that gets in the way of efficiency. And that's really what Donald Trump, in his bluntness, he's able to direct and kind of go after problems in a different way, a problem-solving approach. You know, taking a look at the issues and saying, if in a perfect world, how would you go about doing it? You know, building the wall along the southern border. The way you determine the policy is you talk to the people that are providing the service. The reason the Border Patrol agents, for the first time in their history, endorsed any candidate is that he went there, listened to them, and they told him what needs to be done. Mm-hmm. And then he parroted that, and he said, we have to build a wall. That didn't come from him. That came from the people that supported him. And that's the way...
Neil, I'm just going to interrupt you real quick so that our listeners will know that my guest is Neil Tapio. He's a South Dakota senator from Watertown. We're reaching him in Pierre, but he was in Washington, D.C. for the inauguration, had a conversation on the plane on the ride home, he says, with two women who were heading to the protests for the Women's March. And Neil, I'm wondering, when you were out there, there were protests and such. What was the crowd like? Can you tell me what the mood was like and if you felt the security was solid that day?
We live in a militarized zone. That's the most, that was the first thing that I worked out in Washington, D.C. from 92 to 94 for Senator Pressler, and then I worked the cycle for the Republican Senatorial Committee. There were snipers on almost every roof all the way throughout the District of Columbia. There were walls of army and police with shields and National Guard. This isn't the country that I grew up in. Hmm. The first thing that you noticed was that we don't live in the same environment that we lived in just 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And that's the security concern. The people was there were a lot of Trump fans, a lot of excitement for the Trump folks. I think they're generally very peaceful folks. They're different. They're not necessarily Republican, as you would think about Republicans going to a state party dressed up in a suit and tie. These are blue collar workers. These are people that are plumbers and construction workers, and they just want to believe in a system that makes sense to them. They want to get up in the morning, go to work, be self-reliant, live with a certain level of self-control, respect the rule of law. And whenever anything deviates from that, they get very scared. And that's kind of, I think there's just a difference. One of the things I talked to these two women about was that they were, for the first time in their life, they were scared with our president. Mm. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was interesting, is that I am scared because I see all these security people. Every time I fly, I go through a wall of TSA agents. And every time, you have terrorism around the world and we can't quite get a figure out on it, and we're spending $6 trillion since September 11th fighting this war on terror that we can't quite figure out, well, they somehow can rationalize that in their mind, that that's just the new normal. But they, when they hear Trump talk, they become very scared.
How do you want to change it? That TSA security and the security that was during the inauguration.
Well, that's a long...
we probably don't have time for that. We might have to have you back.
You're going to have me back for the whole afternoon to discuss that. But there are... I guess I would only say that you have to get to the root cause of every issue, completely understand it, break it down into the smallest parts, and only then, when you discuss things in a calm, emotionally free environment, are you able to get solutions that work.
So, Neil, here's my big question for you. On that airplane with those women who come at this this presidency from a different angle than what you have, perhaps, were you able to have that kind of conversation that you felt you understood them a little more and they understood you a little more?
Their takeaway was that I wished you were the press secretary for Trump, because if you can have a rational discussion and have the time to discuss issues without all of the inflammatory statements as a political, but just have a rational discussion, it helps. And they thank me for the conversation, and I thank them for the conversation, because we understood each other more. I understood their fears, and I was able to help allay those fears a little bit. And they understood my fears, and I think they had a new appreciation for that.
What was your takeaway from them?
Well, my takeaway from them is that their impression of Donald Trump was so completely different than my impression of Donald Trump, and that there needs to be almost a translator in his coded language that he uses to the people that are listening to it and saying, wow, that's a shocking statement. Mm-hmm. But if you look, each one of those shocking statements, when we get together and talk again, I can explain to you behind the scenes what each of those means and why you do it. And I was able to fill those in with information. And I truly believe that we had an emotional connection, that we understood each other more than what we did before.
Let's leave it there for next time. Understanding each other a little bit more. And Neil Tapio, will have you back for sure. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you much.
After the break, Spearfish Canyon. We'll hear from some who oppose the land swap. You're in the moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Stick around. Welcome back to In the Moment. If you've been listening to the program these past few weeks, you've heard much about the state's proposed land swap to create a new state park near Spearfish. Today, we hear from a citizen opposed to the deal. Jim Allen is a retired Forest Service employee and public lands liaison with Backcountry Horsemen. Jim, welcome to In the Moment.
Good morning, and thanks for having me.
And we're reaching you from Custer today, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct, just outside of Custer.
Let's start with what troubles you about the state proposal, and maybe there are several things. So what troubles you most about the proposal?
Well, one of the things that troubles us most is that the national forest lands that the state wants to acquire belong to all Americans, and they are our lands, and if they leave the public domain, we can never get them back. They were left by our forefathers, people much wiser than most of us today, as a heritage, and it's a unique inheritance that we've gotten, very unique anywhere else in the world.
And I don't think that people really understand sometimes that you know, this isn't necessarily marked. You don't necessarily know that you've crossed from state land to Forest Service land. I know when I went out there and really started walking around for the first time, I didn't have a true appreciation of that. So what is it about the deal that you think is going to change that protection, though? Because when I talk to folks from state government, they are very much interested in preserving the land for all of us as well. I'm hearing the same thing from both sides about this legacy and heritage of protecting the land.
Yes. You know, the state is capable of preserving lands, and they do a very good job in Custer State Park. It's just that this land is already protected under environmental laws, and there's really no additional protections that the state can provide, because the state does not have as stringent of environmental laws as the federal government has. And it's also managed very carefully by the Forest Service under the Black Hills National Forest Plan. Spearfish Canyon and Little Spearfish is its own management area. Mm. And there are constraints, guidelines, objectives for managing that piece of public land.
Who can manage it best, the federal government or the state government?
Well, I feel that the federal government can, because there are more environmental protections in place than the state. Now, I'll reiterate that, you know, the state does a great job in their state parks, in Custer State Park and in Parks East River, without mm-hmm. a doubt. They provide a very important niche in the recreation community, but then the Forest Service also provides another niche within the recreation community.
Can you give me an example of an environmental protection that's provided by the federal government that's not provided by the state?
Well, the federal environmental laws require the National Environmental Policy Act.
Okay.
Or NEPA is probably the foremost one, and it requires a display of purpose and need to take some sort of an action. It requires a thorough analysis, and it also requires public participation. Mm-hmm. And the state does not have anything like that.
Public participation. So let's talk about what some folks are saying about sort of how this has been communicated by the state and the public feedback. How do you think that's gone?
Well, I think the governor got the cart in front of the horse.
How so?
He came forward with the Spearfish Canyon Park proposal, and then the land exchange was kind of second. Now he has changed and said, well, all right, the park proposal is further down the road, but we want to go ahead with the land exchange. And what they have not done so far is ask the people of South Dakota if they want this land exchange or not. And we're finding significant opposition to the land exchange, and we also find that it is pretty inequitable.
How so? I don't think I fully understand that.
Well, under federal laws, and funny enough, under South Dakota laws, South Dakota Codified Law 41-2-4. The land exchange must be between two willing partners, a willing buyer, a willing seller, and then they must be appraised at fair market value, as if they were on the open market, done by a licensed appraiser. And this is not the case. In the initial legislation that was introduced last session in Congress, it required agricultural value to be used. That's unprecedented in Congress, by the way, that they specify appraisal methods rather than using the federal laws, and the state law is very similar. And we feel that is really unfair to the American taxpayer.
Because the agricultural value would differ? How so?
Well, it doesn't account for any improvements
okay.
That are on the property, like three campgrounds, a lake, Camp Bob Marshall, streams, boat docks, trailheads, trails. It doesn't account for any of the infrastructure that already exists.
All right. What
they
needs to happen?
They just want to trade it straight across acre for acre.
What needs to happen next?
That the state is offering up, all but 34 acres of that, is either short grass prairie or badlands. Mm. Not that those aren't important parts of the prairie ecosystem, but they don't have the same value as land in the Black Hills.
What needs to happen next, Jim?
I think the governor and Secretary Hepler need to honestly ask the people of South Dakota if they want this land exchange to occur.
Mm. And I understand there's several meetings planned and some online participation invited. Is that sufficient to how they're asking right now, or would you like to see something else?
I think the public meeting that's planned this coming Thursday in Spearfish is primarily designed to provide input to the state's master planning process, which would be something of, you know, what do you want your park to look like? You know, what do you want to, what, you know, how many parking spaces do you want? What kind of trailheads, shower houses, whatever?
Mm.
And I think that goes back to my cart in front of the horse thing. They need to actually have a series of public meetings that honestly ask the people, do they really want this land exchange to occur?
What do you think they'll hear back?
I think they will hear that the people of South Dakota don't want this exchange to occur.
Yeah. Are parking spaces part of this plan?
I couldn't tell you. I was just kind of guessing.
Okay, all right, yeah. When I talked to Secretary Hepler, made it
on the website, and it certainly is an impressive website that you know, the public meeting is conducted by the consultant that they've hired to provide input to their master plan.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that's after the land exchange has occurred, if it occurs.
All right. Jim Allen, we're going to keep having this conversation with folks in the future, but I want to say thank you to you for your time. I appreciate it. Come back and talk to us again.
You're very welcome. I'd be happy to discuss this in the future at any time, and I really appreciate you having an opposing viewpoint on the public radio.
We will continue to have conversations from both sides tomorrow. Governor Dennis Dugard joins us. We'll ask him some more questions about Spearfish State Park. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, we invite you to check out, there's a couple ways you can participate. Check out On the Other Hand, which is a blog from SDPB's contributor Kevin Wooster. You can find that at sdpb.org/Wooster. He wrote about this, outlined it, and people are already making lots of comments there. Or you can send us a text, 956-SDPB. Email me in the moment at sdpb.org. We'll keep the conversation going. We'll see you in hour 2.